Welcome to the Udacity Thought Leader Series podcast. In today's episode, Sebastian Thrun sits down with billionaire investor and entrepreneur Vinod Khosla, the founder of Khosla Ventures and Sun Microsystems, to discuss the next wave of tech breakthroughs, why no industry is immune to disruption, and the next 10 years in tech.
Hello to our Udacity Thought Leader Series. My name is Sebastian. Today is a phenomenally great day for me because my really good friend and mentor, Vinod Khosla, is with me. Vinod, as you might know, grew up in India a few years ago, moved to Carnegie Mellon, as I just learned, as a grad student, got a master's degree, then to Stanford, and then was one of the very early entrepreneurs in the Valley, working on Sun Microsystems as a founder, joined later on Kleiner as John Doerr's trusted partner in venture capital, and now runs his own firm, Khosla Venture, with massive investments in energy and education and many other fields, and biomedical systems, medicine. I would say if you rank the people who know something about the Valley in the world, he would be among the top three people, absolutely. Yes, he's seen the world in so many ways and is so wise. And he's also always controversial, which I always like. He's a straight thinker, a logical thinker who doesn't believe in conventional wisdom if conventional wisdom is wrong. Welcome, Vinod.
Well, it's exciting to be here.
You've seen the Valley for such a long time, all the way from Sun Microsystems, which of course got acquired by Oracle, and from the venture side. Is the Valley changing?
Well, the level of activity is clearly changing. And what is changing dramatically is till about 10 years ago, from the beginning of the Valley in the early 70s, the Valley was about technology affecting technology businesses. I think over the last decade, what we've seen is this radical transformation where the Valley technology affects every industry, not just technology industries. So we could sort of dink around in our narrow area of enterprise or mobile or software, but it wasn't about transportation, it wasn't about housing, it wasn't about media. Now, the Valley is about every industry, and quite surprisingly to all the Valley nerds like myself, it has become much more of a global issue than it ever was because it's truly affecting society in a very large way. And we can come back to whether that's likely to continue in the next 10 years. I think it'll be even more explosive the next 10 or 20 years.
You've heavily invested in medical technology and human health services. Give us your vision. What's going to happen there?
Well, one thing's very, very clear. What's not clear to start with is timelines. Correct. But what's very clear is any notion of expertise in any area, and definitely in medicine, will be embodied in AI systems. And so the notion of humans having expertise that systems don't is just a quaint notion. It'll look quaint in 40 years.
But it's more than that, right? Because you can also now bring this expertise to places where it isn't today.
Okay. So let me actually go there. About a year ago, I published a document. I was 63. I'd been thinking since I was 60 about what I want to work on for the next 20 years. And I wrote this document because I wanted to be clear for myself what I wanted to work on. And it's titled Reinventing Societal Infrastructure with Technology. The subtitle is A Call for Entrepreneurs, because no big company, in my view, can reinvent infrastructure. Only startups, entrepreneurs, the Valley can. And I found very surprisingly, there was no large area of GDP where sitting at my ranch, I couldn't come up with technological solutions which were multipliers from 100% to 1,000% on resources. And that's really, really exciting. Back to medicine. And really, I framed this document, which is about 50 pages long, in the context of 700 million people on the planet have a rich lifestyle. It's rich in energy. It's rich in education. It's rich in healthcare. It's rich in living space. It's rich in transportation. We have nice, fancy cars. 7 billion people want it. Can we do a 10x increase in provision of goods and services to the 7 billion people to bring them up to the level of the top 10% without destroying the planet? And I was shocked how easy it was to imagine. In healthcare, for example, it was very, very clear you couldn't start enough medical schools in India to train enough students. You couldn't hire the professors to start enough medical schools. Even with an infinite budget, you couldn't bring the doctor-patient ratio conventionally to where it is in the U.S. today, which is not adequate. So if you sort of said, well, is there another way? An AI doctor would absolutely scale this. And so I do think 24/7 personal physician for every person on the planet at close to zero cost per month is feasible. And so I got my son working on that now. But it's also true. It's silly to not have an AI oncologist. It's such a deterministic field.
Yeah, it's very true.
And in all this, we're doing this in cardiology, we're looking at that, we're looking at it in mental health. There's hardly a specialty that isn't subject to this kind of packaged expertise into an AI system, which will then learn across all the patients, and the rate of learning will be faster than for human experts.
When you say these things, many people will hear you say, jobs will go away. Like Sam Altman is building OpenAI, and he says the last company ever built, because once he succeeds, it's going to build all the other companies for him.
Yeah.
What's your take on that one?
Well, so I am one of the large investors in OpenAI, so there's a reason to be invested. I do believe AI is possible or powerful. I would say, first, one caveat. When I talk about expertise, it doesn't take away the human element of care. But I'd rather have a great nurse than a great physician. And funnily, I recommended to the dean of Harvard Medical School about 3 or 4 years ago that they stop selecting for IQ, because you have to be so smart to get into Harvard Medical School, you have no EQ. And I suggested he look at the USC Film School as a criteria for admission into the medical school at Harvard.
Good-looking daughters.
And more empathetic and more mirror neurons. I do believe we will get to a point looking at traditional economic metrics, GDP growth, productivity growth, we will do very, very well when these systems kick in. And I don't believe they've started to kick in. We will have great abundance. The only thing we will have, unless we do something about it, will be economic disparity. And in 2004, I wrote a piece in Forbes on great GDP growth, AI will drive great GDP growth, great productivity growth, great economic metrics, and great abundance with increasing disparity. So I do think our social problem will be disparity, but we will have way more resources than we can imagine today to address disparity. So even into 2014, I proposed that some form of universal basic income will be essential. I still subscribe to that view. Mm-hmm. Bill Gates has proposed a robot tax. So the issue of more goods and services for an economy is separate from how we distribute it.
Yep.
And I do agree the system is unfair and biased towards the haves and not the have-nots.
Yeah.
Which is why, by the way, I think for those of you listening out there, a primary care doctor and oncologist and a cardiologist for every single person will increase that. I also, one of my favorite projects is to do an AI lawyer so every person can have a personal lawyer to enforce their rights. One of the sad facts is for most people who need to file for bankruptcy today in the U.S., they don't have the enough money to hire a lawyer to file for bankruptcy. And lawyers don't let you bypass them.
I'm looking forward for the day where your judge and your lawyer, both sides, is an AI system. So you just cable them together and out comes the verdict.
I've actually proposed that in most arbitration, companies and employees and others agree to AI lawyers, AI judges, where an AI knows when to triage an issue up to a human judge for now, when the issue is ambiguous. It would save a lot of money and cost.
It would draw a crazy line that if an AI system could judge over you and fine you as a human being, that would certainly be a step further to give up to the machines.
Well, great jumps in technology lead to great jumps in uncertainty. Mm-hmm. And we just have to realize we will have to deal with them. Mm-hmm. And if we avoid them, we will give up a lot of upside and benefit for humanity. The better approach is to recognize that these things will happen, mm-hmm. that we will be surprised with the unintended consequences that we have to be able to address. I'm not scared of AI as a sentient being. I do think we can harness it for mankind's purpose.
I'm with you. A while back, you heavily invested in energy. I remember this. And there was, when I was just entering the Valley as a junior professor, there was this incredible focus on energy and many funds. What happened to it?
Well, so energy is interesting. Its timelines are very different. Mm. They do take a long time.
Like decades.
Right. We invested very early, so we were one of the first funds. We did not chase it in the later stages, mm-hmm. which many funds did. Mm-hmm. And in the venture business, you rely on other investors to come in and keep funding a company you started funding.
I know.
It's sort of this pyramid, almost pyramid-like scheme. But everybody along the way gets benefit. I think whenever hype cycles happen, that investment valuations go through the roof, and then when they come crashing down, then funding dries
up. Let me ask you, are we in a hype cycle right now with self-driving cars? There's so many companies now, and valuations reaching multiple billions before there's even a product on the market.
Yeah. I do believe the market is large enough where it's hard for me to judge whether we are in a hype cycle or not. But we can come back to that. Finishing on energy, we actually decided when the market changed to triage fairly aggressively on which companies support and which companies not do. So in our portfolio from then, one, the fund has done much better than most people think. Our energy fund, double-digit returns, which actually is not bad in the, it'd be top of the class in energy. But you take large transformative technologies. I think some of those will result in that. Tesla is a great example. It's transformed the auto industry. Yeah. QuantumScape here most likely will change the battery industry. But it takes 7-8 years to develop that kind of a product for automotive standards.
That's true.
So it is already a unicorn if you look at the last valuation, and they have plenty of money. LanzaTech's doing steel mill exhaust gases. It's taking carbon dioxide and partially combusted carbon monoxide. And the company is doing very well. I'm almost certain it'll be a unicorn, doing extremely well. ViewGlass just got a valuation of $3 billion. Mm-hmm. All from the same cohort. I could go on and on. I think a company like Kalera, which has lost visibility, will revolutionize cement production. Mm-hmm. So cement, transportation, steel, glass and buildings, these are massively transformative technologies. Yeah. You add to that other sustainability technologies like Impossible Foods. It's fun. This is the fun part of the valley. I think we invested in hamburgers and rocket launches at Rocket Lab about the same time. And they launched about the same time.
Which one's more important?
Well, hard to say which one's more important.
Both are.
Right?
The Impossible Foods is a great company.
Impossible Foods is a great company, but it can transform the planet. The goal is to free up 30% of the planet's land area. It's not for the faint of heart to be that ambitious. And the founder, Pat Brown, is just amazingly. But I have no question it is on path to be, it's already a unicorn, but it is on path to be a very large company if they execute well. And nice. There's always an if.
Tell me.
Look, clean tech was not a failure as people view it. We started four battery companies. I think three of the four will make us money. And one of the four, QuantumScape, will make a lot of money. We started three solar companies and probably four, maybe two of the four will make money for us. So we clearly had some spectacular failures in biofuels. But LonzaTech will make up for many of them because it's doing so well.
Nice.
Right? So this is the nature of the venture business.
Let's talk about other fields that are not yet disrupted. I would say banking, fintech. There's this constant threat of fintech companies chiseling into banking. Yeah. But I haven't seen the massive change yet.
Well,
what's your prediction for that?
You haven't, but you take a small product that nobody knows, like Square Cash.
Yes, which I know well.
You know, we invested in the Series A of Square. The company is worth about $25 billion or something now. But more importantly, in the last two or three years, if you look on Twitter, they don't call it Square Cash, they call it Cash App. People are using it as a bank account. There are many, many people depositing their paychecks into Square Cash. So you say a huge bank after 100 years has 35 million accounts and something growing from scratch to 16 million monthly actives, the writing is on the wall another 3 years.
So what you're saying is it's happening right now. Just open your eyes, Sebastian.
Yeah.
All these little pieces, put these pieces together. Sure. So then tell me the next 10 years of the future of banking.
Five years from now, I think somebody new, whether it's Square or Apple or PayPal, will be the largest bank in the consumer bank in the United States.
Facebook, possibly. He wants to copy WeChat.
Yes. So entirely possible that's what will happen in banking. That, by the way, then leads to this capital. And banking is like 60% mortgage lending for all the consumer banks. That will be deployed much more efficiently and without the overhead of traditional banks.
Which brings me to regulations, right? So in medicine, in banking, there's this incredible strong piece of regulatory oversight that forces on banks really bad balance sheets, incredible compliance. In medicine, it's even worse. Approval of medication, reimbursement codes, moving at glacial speeds. How does this come together?
Right. So there's many ways. In banking, wallets don't have all the compliance requirements. But if you, for example, used AI for compliance, not 10,000 back office workers in India or the Philippines, which is what the banks do, you're going to completely eliminate compliance overhead. Compliance is for a good reason. I'm not saying it shouldn't be there. A lot of fraud happens when you don't have compliance rules. But that compliance can absolutely be made much better and very low cost with AI. So when people talk about it has all this overhead, yes, because they got 10,000 people doing what is now being addressed with what is basically process, back office processes in outsource legacy branches that shouldn't exist. All this infrastructure will go away, and I think we can keep all the compliance and yet have a new style of banking with very low cost. So no question about it. Lending becomes much more unbiased. When lending happens today, it is extremely biased by the biases of the humans doing the lending based on their prior experience. That will change.
And be better, more efficient.
Better, cheaper, more accessible, and more efficient. Absolutely. Mm. That's true in banking. In medicine, if primary care for a month costs less than the cost of copay, the world is a different place.
That's very true.
My bet is what is called copay today is more than enough to provide the whole service in many, many cases, not all.
Wow. So no health insurance. It's your future for health insurance.
Yeah.
You don't need it. You make it affordable.
Well, you will need catastrophic health insurance. Right. If but you need a liver transplant, that's a or a cardiac surgery, that's a whole different thing. Hmm. But could you maintain cardiac health for less than $10 a month? Absolutely. And have much better 24/7 AI chatting with you and advising you. Right? Yeah. You can do that in primary care. You can do it in mental health.
Almost everything, I agree.
Yeah.
Tell me about, as an investor, you're an early stage investor, so you work with lots of small founding teams. Mm-hmm. What makes to you a winning pitch or a winning founding team you want to support?
It's unreasonable founders. Unreasonable founders who don't take no for an answer, persist through lots of down cycles because startups are about up and down cycles. And I have a great presentation I first wrote up in 1986 called The Entrepreneurial Roller Coaster, where the highs are high and the lows are low.
It's like Ben Horowitz's book.
Yeah. And I literally did this in 1986, the same presentation. It's now translated to the new version of PowerPoint, but other than that, it hasn't changed much. It's founders with persistence, clarity of thinking, and a large mission.
How much is experience important for you?
Not very. In fact, I would argue that in the startup world, the more experience you have, the more biases you have, and the less likely you are to innovate in any area.
So I, as a Stanford professor, should not be running Udacity.
Well, you don't know much about... let me put it this way. I look back at the last 40 years, and I could not find one large example of innovation coming from people who had experience in their industry. Genentech was started in Kleiner Perkins' offices with no pharmaceutical experience. All of biotechnology happened because of an intern at Kleiner Perkins in the 70s. Twitter and Facebook and YouTube innovated media. It wasn't Fox and CBS and NBC. It wasn't Boeing and Airbus or Lockheed that did space. It was SpaceX and Rocket Lab. It wasn't General Motors and Volkswagen.
Who built self-driving cars? That's Google.
Self-driving cars, it's Google. And on the electric cars, it's Tesla. In banking, it's Square and PayPal, not Visa and Bank of America. Like, I couldn't find one large innovation. Incremental innovations, yes. That came from somebody who knew an area. And this is why. When you join an area, if you bring all your biases, you're likely going to end up with the same answers. When you think from first principles and clearly, in 6 months, you know as much about the field as people with 10 years of experience, but you have a fresh look and you test every assumption.
So let's say you're Bank of America and you're listening to this and you look at this, a little bit shivering with your hands because your experience, you're also a bit older. What would be advice be for, say, the CEO of Bank of America? What should he do if they really want to
let me give you the flip example. They'll start an innovation group, any large financial group. It's some people on the side, and they can't do certain things because it affects their major businesses. Mm-hmm. Right?
So you almost want to invest then, or?
Here's the other thing, right? So let's say a project isn't, innovative project isn't going well. What happens in Bank of America? The people transfer to a good area. First, they're not struggling with getting funding every year. And so they take the long view and they don't test in a very rapid way all their assumptions. They just assume their assumptions to be true. When things run into trouble, they find other jobs laterally within Bank of America. What does an entrepreneur do? They know their life depends on it. They have no option. They're testing every assumption. They're looking at all the ways in which they may be wrong. And they have no way out. So necessity is the mother of invention. That's why it's very hard. So should they? Absolutely, they should invest. GM buying Cruise is an example. There's no way GM could have done that on their own. right?
So if you build an, the lesson would then be, if you build an Lockheed Martin Skunkworks or Google X, make sure the people there are desperate.
Yeah.
Have little resources and are forced to stick with it even if things don't go well.
The less resources you have, the more your probability of success.
That is very true.
Right? Because you test your assumptions more, you do lots of incremental things, and you get evolutionary exponentials, not planned big leaps, which never work. That's like the Russian economy version of startups.
Let's go back to your youth. You grew up far away from here in India. Mm-hmm. Udacity has a huge following in India of really enthused people. And you in many ways are an incredible role model for so many people there. What advice would you give yourself to your younger self still in India? What did you do well? What did you do differently?
Well, I think I was very, very lucky. I used to read very old issues of Electronic Engineering Times. So a year or two after they were current here, they got shipped to India, and I could go to a place in Old Delhi and rent those magazines. So in Old Delhi, I could go rent old magazines, and I'd read them, and I read about Andy Grove starting up Intel. And I've told Andy Grove this story when he was alive. He was an inspiration for me. And I said, here's this Hungarian immigrant coming to Silicon Valley and starting a company. Why can't I do that? And that became real motivation. So motivation matters. Mm-hmm. And I think I was right. I was naive about the fact that I was taking a lot of risks. But I sort of had this arrogant confidence in myself that, first, I didn't need much more than McDonald's to eat, get food. Mm-hmm. And a $200 a month apartment. That's what I felt I needed back then. And so I felt like I could always get a job. So if something failed or I got fired or whatever, I wasn't ever worried about the downside. And every person has to make their own trade-off. I'd rather make take the risk of failing often, but if I succeed, being very successful. I like to say most people, whether it's people, managers, businesses, reduce risk to the point where their probability of success goes up, but the consequences of success become inconsequential. I choose to make the other trade-off. I tell young people, be explicit. Now, to be honest, I don't understand why anybody, especially young people, would make the trade-off in terms of conservatism. It makes no sense at all because it affects all of the rest of your life. And even when you fail, your rate of learning is so great when you take risks that that's what every young person should be doing.
I have to say, I find life without risk boring, just boring.
Yeah, it is boring without risk.
Forget the upside. It's much more fun to experience new stuff. So you're, I guess, you're then fearless. How do you make other people fearless?
I think
storytelling. Fearless.
Look, humans respond to storytelling. And so examples, talking about it like we are doing here, role models really help. Andy Grove was a role model for me. It's most rewarding for me when I get these emails and get them. like this was, this is a model, you are a model for me, some 25-year-old. Mm-hmm. And that's exciting. It is scary because sometimes they say they gave up this good job to take this risk just because they heard some talk by you. I think I did a talk in 2015 at Stanford Business School, and I told the audience of 400 MBAs that I wasn't speaking to most of them, just two or three of them who would change their trajectory based on this hour I was going to spend. I've gotten I still get regularly emails of people who still hear that talk and say, hey, I'm changing my career, my path.
What was the message in that talk?
The message was be internally driven. Don't let society determine what you should be or what's expected of you. You know, every Indian, their parents say, expect them to be a doctor or an engineer. Like, don't follow that rule. Be internal, be driven by what you believe in, but also merge that with what's pragmatic. So follow your dream is not good advice. Follow your dream in a way that's pragmatic, if you're successful, is much better advice.
When you look around the valley from people like Larry Page and Elon Musk and Mark Zuckerberg, they seem to all be a bit, hard to say, distant from people emotionally. Is that a feature that makes a good entrepreneur? To be less connected to people?
I think not necessarily. I think what's important is not to be overly influenced. Mm. And I talked a while ago about first principles thinking. If you're first principles thinking, you can take lots and lots of input and advise everybody to get lots of input, but then not follow it, but synthesize your own path based on the input. Mm. There's a very distinct line between getting lots of input and following lots of input versus synthesizing that into your own trajectory. Most people going through that, I've always done that. It came naturally to me.
You're one of the very few, I think, that talks about it. I think so does Elon Musk, so does Larry, but most people don't think this way.
Yeah.
It's really interesting. It's something I would love to share with the audience, honestly, because that's what makes all great innovation happen. Just think about it logically. Like, why do people die of cancer? They shouldn't. It's totally preventable. Good. Last question for you. We know I love talking to you. Silicon Valley is a bit of a bubble in some sense. You get these rebels here who think logically and build big businesses. I'm sure you've been asked this question many, many times, but what stops this kind of DNA from engulfing the entire world? Why is there not Silicon Valley in India, in Europe, perhaps in most places of China?
So let me say, first, give a word of caution. There's an appropriate time to be a rebel, right? Uh-huh. So I don't, for example, recommend people drop out of college. You know, there's a base level of...
I do.
Which is fine.
Come to Gedacity. You can learn much better skills at a much lower rate and we've done faster. Sorry, I had to do this.
I understand. But learning base skills, so that you have any skills, anywhere you do it, where you can always make a comfortable life for yourself initially, your family later, really, really important. But then, once you reach that level of knowledge, you want to increase your rate of learning by taking lots of risks, experimenting a lot, trying new things. And that's a culture. I like to say Silicon Valley isn't a place, it's a culture. And it's this culture of it's okay. You know, if I go to New Delhi today and somebody is recruiting and say, oh, that person has 20 years of experience at Cisco or IBM or GE, that's health, that's treated with reverence. If I see that resume, I'm not going to talk to that person. I'm not hiring anybody who's worked for 20 years at one of these companies. Like, if they had any self-respect, any risk-taking, they'd be out of there so fast. It's a disqualification in my world. That culture here, for an entrepreneur, for a 25-year-old, is supported by investors who do that. Other executives who are willing to take a job at a startup instead of at Google, which is safe. So whether it's hiring more management to help you, whether it's getting investors to take the long view or take this ridiculous view of, oh, you're worth $1 billion with $1 million in revenue, and the ecosystem of people who'd be embarrassed to say, don't take risk, that's the culture of the Valley that needs to be replicated. And frankly, if it is replicated in other parts of the world, we are going to see a lot more innovation. There is lots more headroom for innovation. Let me end there, because people always think there's only a few places where innovation can happen. When we did Impossible Foods, the Impossible Burger, people said, you're innovating in hamburgers? What's there to innovate? A 90% reduction in land area needed to produce a meat, 80% reduction in carbon emissions or water use. Those are stunning innovations, stunning. In fact, more than anything that's happened in software. We are 3D printing, experimenting with 3D printing houses now. Yes. We have three construction startups. Like, who would have thought construction, transportation, food would be areas for innovation? There is no area that is not open to radical innovation, in my view. It's just people's mindset limits them. People always find it easier to explain why something will fail than to say, I'll figure out a way around that failure. So that's a good place to end.
It's a great place to end. I 100% agree. I would challenge anybody watching this, go and innovate tonight, get a glass of beer and think about something crazy. I would say everything crazy can be done. The people who say it can't be done are always wrong. We know it.
In parting, we just funded a seed project to do Mach 5 passenger jets.
Good. Which
is, by the way, London to New York in an hour and a half, yeah. The world would be closer together.
I agree. And it should be done, and it can be done. There's no physical reason why it shouldn't be done.
Absolutely.
A great business case. You know, thank you so much. I could speak hours with you. I've learned so much from you. He's one of my heroes and role models, and everything I say, as you say, I mean, it's just very logical.
Thank you. It's great to always chat with you, so it's always fun. Thank you.